Okay.
Go ahead, Psalm 23.
Psalm 23. The Lord watches my back. He always makes sure I got enough Kool-Aid and Hot Cheetos. He gets me the presidential suite with the crystal flowing. He restores my soul, but I'm not a soldier. Even though I ride through gangster's paradise, I won't be scared, because you pimped out my caddy with bulletproof glass. You got me prime rib up in my enemy's crib. You tricked me out with the fattest ice. You like ba-bam, foreign up in the glizzle. I'll be up in the his house of the OG original God. My life be like ooh-ah, ooh-ah.
Thank you, Gans. Okay, don't read that translation. I have no idea what you said. Not one word. Except the. Okay, some more stuff about the Bible. Good. Okay. What to look for when you read the Bible? The first thing to look for is that which is most obvious. Most obvious. It's easy to think you're going to look for some kind of hidden message or some kind, something that's deep. It's usually just whatever it says, right there on the surface. So look for the most obvious first. The second thing to look for is the literary genre and context. Ask yourself, what kind of literature is this? And even though you don't know all the details, just being aware, this is an epistle, okay, what's that like? And what are some of the basic rules that I should expect in understanding this? Or this is one of the Psalms, or this is a proverb. What kind of rules do you think would go involved and be involved with that? And think about the literary context. You know what the context, the literary context is? There's two contexts of the passage. There's the historical context, which is, of course, who wrote it, to whom, when, why, etc. Then there's the literary context. What words come before it and after it? One of the worst violations of that is the use of Philippians chapter 4, verse 19, loosely translated, "My God will meet all of my needs according to his riches and glory in Christ Jesus." Real popular verse, and it's used, and the Bible is treated almost like it's a magic book. There's these magic verses, and you pull one out, and then you say incantations over it by saying it a certain number of times in a certain really spiritual way, and it happens. Nobody bothers to think, now, who did Paul say that to? And why did he say it to the Philippians and not to the Corinthians? Why is it in Philippians, not Corinthians? Does that matter? Yes, it matters very much. Paul wrote it to the Philippians because Paul's writing somewhere around 61, 62 AD, his first Roman imprisonment, and he came to Philippi 49 or 50 AD. So for the last 12 years, he's had a relationship with the Philippian church, and on at least four occasions, they've sent considerable financial offerings to him. And even more than that, they've been his primary partner church, helping him financially do his mission. And so to a people that are, Paul even uses the Philippians to convict the Corinthians, because the Corinthians are holding back on a pledge that they committed to. And in essence, it's like your dad or mom saying, why can't you be like your older brother? Corinthians, why can't you be like the Philippians, who in a great poverty of need still begged us for the favor of giving? So we see something about the Philippians or from Macedonia, the Macedonians' attitude about giving and money. They've got a 12-year track record of continual generosity and giving. And Paul says to them, God will meet your needs. He didn't say it to the Corinthians. You see, because there were financial issues. They were holding back. They made pledges, but now they're not sure they wanted to follow through on them. And they have bad attitudes about giving. They don't get the same promise. You see? Now that comes just from like looking at the literary context. Rather than just grabbing some verse and just dealing with it fast and loose and just taking that because I like that and it says what I want it to say. Who was it written to? And why does that matter? Does that make sense? So look around. Don't just grab verses out. Try to figure out the flow of thought that's taking place. Especially if you do that month exercise where you just read one book. Try to ask yourself, why is the author saying that now? And then what do you think he'll say next? Ooh, why didn't he say what I thought he was going to say? Why did he say that? How do these things all connect? You see, there's a flow of thought. And the more you capture the flow of thought and understand the broad context, the more the individual pieces will start to come together for you. Of course, it helps before you start, if you're going to do an epistle like that, to do just a little cursory research and find out who wrote it, when, why, some of the basic details behind it, which all that material is just available with a few clicks of a mouse. You can find that out. And in a matter of a few minutes, you can have a working knowledge of the Philippian situation or what's happening in Colossae and why Paul wrote it. And now as you approach the text, all those words have a lot more meaning to you. Make sense to you? Third thing to look for. So first, what's most obvious, then genre and context. Third thing to look for is words. Look for words. I'm quoting Mortimer Adler, who wrote a pretty famous book called How to Read a Book. You ever seen it? How to Read a Book. And in it, he says this. You don't have this on your notes, but I'll read it to you. He says, a word can have many meanings, especially an important word. If the author uses a word in one meaning and the reader reads it in another, words have passed between them, but they've not come to terms. Where there's unresolved ambiguity in communication, there is no communication. That's an important point when we look at the words that the authors are using. What does that word that he's using, what does it mean to the author? So it really doesn't matter what that word means to you. It matters what it means to the author. Some of the things you do under this is you look for key words that are repeated in the passage. Gives you a good idea of what the author's saying. Some Bible helps for a particular book of the Bible, we'll give you a list of all the main words that are used and how many different times. It gives you a real good understanding. For example, if you're reading Romans, there's a few key words you're going to keep bumping up against. Righteousness, for example, is really important if you're going to have any idea what's going on. What does Paul mean when he uses that word? Because he keeps using it over and over. And if you just have a vague understanding in your mind, you're just going to have a vague understanding of what he's trying to say. The clearer you get that word in your mind, the more you'll understand what's being said. Mark uses the word immediately, constantly. Matter of fact, in the first chapter, he uses the word 10 times. Now, if you got the King James, it's translated straightway. But NIV uses the word immediately, and immediately, immediately, immediately. You start seeing that word. Why is this word being used over and over and over? Well, we find out that Mark is the interpreter for Peter, Mark wrote his gospel. Mark was a disciple of Peter. And he wrote his gospel from the stories that Peter had told him about walking with Jesus. So when we read Mark's account, it's Peter's picture. That's why it's the shortest gospel. That's why it's the action gospel. That's why it's immediately. Doesn't that sound like Peter? You see, throughout Mark, Mark continually tells us that Jesus taught, but then refuses to tell us what he actually taught. He said Jesus taught, and then we get on to the miracles. Because you can just tell Peter, he's kind of, come on, let's get to the stuff. Okay, yeah, let's get to the stuff, man. Let's get to laying on of hands and raising the dead and miracles. So Mark is like a summer action blockbuster, okay? There's not a lot of character development, but there's a lot of explosions. A lot of things are happening. And you get some keys when you see this word immediately. Wow, 40 times this word shows up. That's an insight. Look for words that define the relationship between things. Words that define the relationship between things. I'll explain what I mean. These are the words that are often passed over, but they give us a lot of insight. For example, when we see the word however, nevertheless, or yet, we automatically know what? It's contrast. There's contrast, right? If we see the word if or whoever, then we know it's conditional. Okay, that's an important insight. If we see the word also, likewise, in the same way, we know it's what? It's comparison. Things are being compared. If we see therefore, thus, so then, what do we understand? Cause and effect. Cause and effect, that's insight for us. We see the word now, immediately, when, before, after, during. Those are temporal clues. They key us that what's happened at a certain time is important for us to know about that particular time. Or we see the word like where or from. Those give us geographical clues, gives us insight. So when you look for those little words that most people pass over, but it shows you the relationships between things that begin to open up insights to what the author is saying. All right, and the last one under this category is the fourth thing to look for is principles. Principles. Now, a principle is a timeless truth that transcends the particular situation. A principle is a timeless truth that transcends the specific cultural situation. And this is important because many situations in Scripture are dissimilar from what we encounter today. We just don't have to deal with the issue of meat sacrificed to idols. At least we don't in Nashville. I don't know if it's, is it an issue here?
Eggs?
Now that's a totally dissimilar issue. And yet there are two chapters of the New Testament dedicated to how we relate to that situation. What do we do? Let's just tear that part out. That is so pointless. No, there are principles hidden, you see. Although the situations are totally dissimilar, there's a principle or principles in there that are vital to us today. So we look for the principles. What are the transcendent truths that have particularity in that idol sacrifice and situation, but could relate to so many other different situations? And there's a tremendous number of important, essential principles in those two chapters that we can understand, that we can apply to very real daily situations that we deal with today. So we're always looking for the underlying principle implied by the text. All right, some questions to ask when you read the Bible. Effective Bible reading. Effective Bible reading involves bombarding the text with questions. Bombarding the text with questions. And there's just a short list. I got a much longer list. I just took some of the highlights and I organized them under the five basic who, what, when, where, why questions, right? So who's writing? Who's he writing to and why? Who is the author? What is the author's subject? What's the life situation of the author? Does what the author is experiencing affect what he's writing? Yeah, it does. What's the life situation of the hearers? What's going on in their life? What important words are repeated and what do they mean? What literary form is the author using and why? What's the emotional state of the author? How does that affect his writing? See, if you don't grasp the emotional state of the Apostle Paul when he's writing the letter to the Galatians, you'll miss a lot of what's being said. There's a clear emotional state that comes through in Galatians. You know yourself, you write something in the heat of emotion, it's going to look different than you write it after letting it set for 3 or 4 weeks. And so a lot of Paul's writings are written on the spur of the moment. What's the emotional state and how does it affect what he's saying? What's the point of the verse, paragraph, the chapter, the book? What did this passage mean to the first hearers? What did they hear when it was being read to them? When does the action take place and why is that significant? Where does the author write from and how did that affect his writing? See, Paul wrote his letter to the Romans on a 3-month little break when he was in Corinth. Now, Corinth is the first century version of Las Vegas, Sin City. What happens in Corinth stays in Corinth. And it's in that city that he writes this diatribe against the sins of the Gentiles. Did that affect his writing? He's just looking out his window and he just bombarded with sin everywhere. It affects his writings. Where do the hearers live and how do their circumstances affect their writing? Interesting, John, well, recording Jesus writing to the church in Laodicea, and he said that they were not hot or cold, but they were lukewarm, and as a result, he was going to, vomit them out of his mouth. Well, every Laodicean immediately understood because of where they live. You see, Laodicea was a part of a tri-city area, Hierapolis, Colossae, and Laodicea, all three in a tri-city, very close to one another. You could see the different cities from different points. And Hierapolis, they had their water source, they had hot springs. And so Hierapolis was a big tourist area. People went to take the cure in the hot springs. Colossae was by the Lycus River, which is a very fast-moving river, and the water was so cold it was difficult to drink because it was so cold. Hot, cold, but Laodicea didn't have its own water source. They got water from a Roman aqueduct that transported the water about 6 miles. And by the time it got there, it was not hot, it was not cold, it was lukewarm. And because the aqueduct was aged, as the water passed through it, it picked up those minerals. And when you drank it, if you were a tourist, it made you throw up. So that was the saying when you went to Laodicea, don't drink the water because it'll make you throw up. And so everything about where they lived makes sense of that passage. Why is the author writing to the particular hearers? Why this group and not somebody else? How does the author present the subject? How does the author introduce his subject? How does the grammatical structure of the verse, passage, or book affect the message? How does the author's culture and historical setting affect the writing? Now, some of these questions, of course, you can only answer with Bible helps. But a lot of them you can answer just by reading carefully the text and the context. And the point of this list is to sort of jog in you this thought that I got to make up my own questions. So just reading on, just stop and ask myself, why is this here? What does this mean? Why did he say this? What does this word mean? What did those first people, when they were sitting in that living room and that letter was being read, how did it sound to them? Try to put yourself in their situation and hear. And as you're bombarding the text with questions, new questions are going to arise. Matter of fact, you're going to find out, wow, I may be more confused than when I started, at least initially. But you keep asking questions, asking questions, asking questions. All right, any thoughts, any questions? Because we're going to do an exercise. Any questions? Everybody ready to exegete? Someone asked you, what'd you do today? We exegeted. Are you ready to exegete? Any questions? Everybody grasp the material 100%. Okay, here we go. Okay, this is going to be difficult here. Thank you, Cricket. This is group work. Although, see, I only want to give you one. This is going to be kind of difficult. Giselle, help me out here, will you? I don't want to give him two. I just want to give him one. So can you just take part of these and kind of split up to the group?
So why don't you split? I'm going to ask a question.
Go ahead. I don't want him to have number two. Just give him number one. Ask a question. That's for your table.
Okay, I wanted to ask, why is it, this is
just
my...
one per table. If you can give us just one, thank you.
My son asked me this question last night, and I couldn't answer.
Yeah.
Because now in Roman Catholic Church, they're teaching that there are two creation stories.
Okay, because there are...
Because Genesis 1 is different from Genesis 2.
Yeah, well, just read them. They're different.
Yeah, but they're one same Genesis, right? I mean, I just wanted to make sure I have this. Isn't Genesis 1 like an overview of the whole whatever happened to the creation? And Genesis 2 is actually a detailed story of day 6. Am I right or wrong?
I wonder. When you get your paper, start with your group. Carlos, you're going to need a group. And let me have a copy so I can read. Go join that group. Okay. Attention. Let me just read it for you. Here's your assignment. Examine the passage in the light of its context. All right? So you may need some help beyond what you've got on this page here. Answer the questions that follow. For though we live in the world, we do not wage war as the world does. The weapons we fight with are not the weapons of the world. On the contrary, they have divine power to demolish strongholds. We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God, and we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. A little bit of information. After Paul wrote 1 Corinthians, he made a brief visit to Corinth where he was not received by a significant percentage of the church. Paul then sent another letter to Corinth, not one that we own or have, strongly reproving the church. This letter was well received by the majority of the church. They repented of their actions against Paul, and they changed their attitude towards him. However, a vocal minority of the church still opposed Paul's apostolic authority and questioned his credentials. Paul then wrote 2 Corinthians to answer these critics, and to defend his calling and credentials. So what I want you to figure out is, what is the subject of this passage? Bombard it with questions. See what you come up with. What did the passage mean to the first hearers? Try to put yourself in their situation. And in one sentence and summarize, explain what verses 3 through 5 refer to. All right? Yes, Ado? Yes, go ahead. All right, begin. You need a Bible. If you need a Bible, sure. Now, just Bibles, okay? I don't want you researching commentaries. Please, just Bibles. No commentaries. Find out what so-and-so says about it. What? Yeah, yeah. Not acceptable. All right. Let's wrap it up. Just have to live with what you got. The bell has rung. I'd like to hear from this first group up here. Tell me what you got. So, first question, what's the subject of this passage? There's a microphone right there. First group, go ahead. What do you got?
We wrote here that Paul was explaining himself why he did not need to fight or defend himself against the accusations of his detractors the way the world would normally defend himself.
So when he's demolishing strongholds, what's that? Somebody from your table, respond.
Yeah, worldviews, demolishing strongholds.
What worldviews?
Maybe how they thought. They thought that maybe somebody with apostolic authority would be somebody who was like a forceful, eloquent man. Because he said, I'm not bold when I'm in front of you,
okay. But
when I write, when I would be bold. So you're judging by appearance. So he wants to demolish those worldviews and say, apostolic authority does not come from that. It actually comes from the knowledge of Christ and the obedience to it.
Okay, good. And so take captive every thought. What does that mean?
Are you asking us? I thought
first
next
group.
Again, I thought next group. Yes, again, sorry. Sorry, sir.
Take captive every thought. What does that mean? How does that fit?
Actually is that every worldview that you have or idea, we have to put it under the subject of the knowledge of Christ and the view of Jesus Christ and the salvation through grace and not through works. You know, that whole line. So that whatever worldview is contrary to that is not accepted.
Okay. Next, pass the mic back. Who's speaking in that group right there? What did this passage mean to the first hearers?
Yeah, first is the majority, and the other one is for the minority. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Chryso speaking now, everyone.
Okay, we identified that there are two hearers, like the majority and the minority. The first hearers, we think that this is an encouragement or exhortation to fix their eyes on God, the ultimate source of
on
their reasoning or focus on God. Ultimate authority. Focus on God's ultimate authority. We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. So we focus on God.
Okay.
And for the minority, I think this is in a way maybe a correction to them that they should not use human reasoning, but instead they should focus on knowing who God is.
Okay. Pass it back. Next group. So in one sentence, what does verses 3-5 refer to? Somebody.
I'm sorry, please repeat the question.
No.
Just number three lang. Number three. In one sentence. Well, we think it's referring to the importance of remembering that they are one part of one spiritual family. And in doing so, they to keep in mind that because they are a part of one family, when they need to have one standard.
We're talking about verse 3-5.
Yes. No, well, because we looked at the context. There's a couple of verses.
In one sentence, explain what verses 3 through 5 refer to.
Okay, verses 3 to 5 refer to the demolishing of strongholds.
That, and what does that mean? What are the strongholds? How are they demolished?
Well, we felt the strongholds that Paul was referring to are not literal. It's figurative, and it's about the moral situation in Corinth.
The what situation?
The moral situation in Corinth.
What moral situation in Corinth?
There were people. From the context that we read, that there were people in the church who did not approve of his authority.
Okay.
And these people were, these people were speaking against him.
Yeah.
So
how do we demolish him?
How would they demolish it?
I asked you first.
Okay, I'm out.
You pass. Let me ask you this question. When this passage is normally read, what's the usual reference or context? Spiritual warfare, right? I don't know if I've ever been to a prayer, spiritual warfare conference or heard a sermon that didn't refer to this verse. Does this verse have anything to do with that? Not in the context it's ever used in. So when you start in verse 3 and end in verse 5, you might think it is. But all you have to do is start in verse 1 and go through verse whatever, and you realize this doesn't have anything to do with intercessory prayer whatsoever. This is all about apostolic authority and the misuse of it or misunderstanding of it, and Paul's attitude towards, God's attitude towards people who disrespect his authority. And amazing that all you have to do is just read a few verses before and a few verses afterwards, and a verse that for years you probably used yourself and quoted yourself, and you realize, whoops, it really doesn't have anything whatsoever to do with that. Yeah? What a lesson that is, huh? All right, let's take a break.